Okay. We will call the meeting to get to order at 7:23 p.m. on April 1st. No puns intended. This is the House Judiciary Committee. We're here to have the first hearing on HB 167 concerning air quality. Present on the committee are Representative Nordland, Representative Phillips, Representative Green, Representative Cott, Representative James, and myself, Representative Porter. We recognize Representative Brown in the audience joining us, and the bill sponsor, Representative Hanley, is here. And please come forward and tell us about the bill, Representative Hanley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee, for a late night on an April Fool's Day. Appreciate you taking the time and scheduling just this on at your meeting. Maybe I could go briefly through the package just so folks know. We've got the sponsor statement. We've got a copy of a committee substitute, and I'll explain a little bit about what the committee substitute and where it came from for that. And that's there are quite a few changes from the original bill, actually, in this committee substitute. There's a sectional analysis behind that. A little bit of information about the Clean Air Act, which is the reason we're here and the reason we're adopting this bill. In the Clean Air Act is stuff about the permits and the fees, as well as the there's been a working committee that's been working on this all interim, and this has got a list of the names of the people and who they represent. There's a list of that, a summary of the Clean Air Act, and then the last thing is a fiscal note in the back. So with that, I'd like to just briefly, if I could, give a little description about where we are, why we're here, and I'm going to keep mine short because Tom Chappell is here from the Department of Environmental Conservation. He's the real expert on the whole thing, and he can answer all the technical questions, and is very well versed in all the aspects of this bill, as well as the Federal Clean Air Act. The Federal Clean Air Act does require us to, well, it doesn't require us to, but they have passed a law that if we don't adopt our own air monitoring system in compliance with the federal law, they will essentially take over themselves, and it could risk us our federal highway funds as well as other funds. And I think there's fairly unanimous consent that for all concerned, it's better to have an Alaskan organization, DEC, running our air quality program than to let the federal government run it. We often run it out of the Seattle office or something like that. They are much more concerned about the specifics of Alaska as far as protecting the specific things in the environment as well as the specific needs of industry and people that are affected by this. Last year, the bill has to pass, or we have to have a program in place by November of this year, and that's why it's critical that this particular piece of legislation or some form of this legislation pass this session so that we can adopt the regulations and have a plan in place to comply with the federal law. The last year, there was a bill, Representative Tom Moyer sponsored a bill, had a number of working groups. I participated in that as well. They had a number of different drafts of trying to compromise. They had groups of industry people and DEC and environmental concerns that worked on the draft last year, and it ended up sitting there. There were some things that couldn't be compromised on, or for a number of reasons it didn't pass last year. After that, the department had started up a working group of industry people, like I said, and it's listed in the back. Number of industry people, an environmental representative, and a public member, and they worked all interim long on a number of the issues, trying to come up with, I guess what you say, the basics to meet the federal requirements. And at the beginning of the session, they had a fairly extensive draft bill dealing with a number of the sections that were that they were able to get through. At that point, the bill that I introduced basically took the parts that they had worked on and added in a number of the things that had been discussed last year but had not been either discussed at all or had been discussed and not dealt with this year by the working group, and that's where the original version of my bill came from, what the working group had plus some of the things that were addressed last year that I felt were important to include in the legislation and have addressed, at least for people's information. Since then, the Senate has had a subcommittee of the Senate Resources Committee. They have invited me and Representative Brown, who also has a bill, to participate. They have been having meetings every Tuesday and Thursday, basically, for the last 3 or 4 weeks, I guess, and trying to work out with DEC and coming up with some of the things. They did a side-by-side of all three versions, the Senate version of the bill, Representative Brown's version, and mine. And in those areas where they were all agreeing on what they were trying to do, make sure that the sections were all the same, that the wording was the same, because many times the paragraphs were a little different, even though they did the same thing. And then the working group also commented on a number of the new sections that were being dealt with that they had not dealt with, and Tom can talk to that as well. And this is basically a result of that process. The Senate version will be almost identical, I believe, to this committee substitute that I have offered here, although there was one thing that was not taken out. We'll get to that later. Maybe one small change that was an oversight. We just got this about, I think it was like 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock this afternoon, trying to get all this stuff incorporated. So there's been a lot of work, and there's been a lot of compromise. I think we've got it down to, and I don't want to mislead you, I think that out of 40 pages and 33 sections, there are probably 28 sections of the 32 sections that are, I would say, agreed upon, or, you know, people don't have a problem with, a fairly good consensus on it. There are about 4 sections that I think there's a difference of philosophy within different groups as far as what the penalties for the provisions of this should be. There's a section, one of the first sections called the 010 section, that kind of limits the department's ability to exceed the federal standards for air emissions and what they have to do to exceed that, what kind of steps they have to go through. There's some controversy over that. The duration of permits, whether it should be 3 years or 5 years, and a couple of other things. So I think what we've got is a pretty good bill where there's a fair consensus on probably 95% of it, and it'll be focused on probably 4 or 5 sections of policy call basis largely on some of those things. So, and that's what we try to do, is get it down to the consensus parts and then have the discussion hopefully focus on those areas where there is disagreement. So basically that's what you have before you. I think we do need to adopt some version of this year, and it's imperative that we do that. And with that, I'll probably just turn it over to Tom Chatter to go through his presentation. We'll give you a little more description, section by section, and what.
Thank you, Representative Hanley. Any questions of the sponsor? See none. Thank you very much, Mark. If we could ask Tom Chapel with the DEC to come in and tell us who you are for the record and tell us about the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Chapel, and I'm the manager of the air permits group within the air quality section of DEC. And what I would like to do, if it's the desire of the committee, is to give an overview of what the Clean Air Act is asking us to do relative to this permit program, so that there's a basic understanding of why we're doing this and what the major features of it are.
Please.
I have an overhead projector, and it's a little inconvenient, but we could use that wall there. It might take me a minute to get this going.
Mr. Chapel, I wonder, would it be better to use that wall there? Would it be better for committee members?
It might well be. Might be easier
Mr. Chairman,
to see.
Do you think that would be
nice? Yeah, let's take that picture down. Then.
You know, this is Anchorage.
Go ahead, Anchorage.
We were afraid we had lost you. We weren't hearing anything.
No, they're moving one of the exhibits, and it's taking a minute to set up.
Okay, thank you.
We're still here.
Thanks.
Gino's standing by.
That's going to take 2.
Erase
that. Yeah, right. That's eraser number 2.
Anchorage, this is Chairman Porter. The fact that we're showing slides here has nothing to do with April Fools.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Clean Air Act was signed by the President in November 1998, 1990, and we are now basically implementing parts of it already. However, the permit program part of it requires we get some changes in statutory authority. This is really the first major overhaul of the Clean Air Act since 1970. The principal focus of the act is to keep air good, clean up areas that have poor air quality or maintain good air quality in those areas that are currently good. There's a number of different vehicles to accomplish that goal, one of which is permits for stationary sources of air pollution or fixed entities that cause air pollution. The other is looking at mobile sources of air pollution. This bill does not at all deal with mobile sources of air pollution. The authorities we need for that are already in existing law, and those programs are underway. What we're talking about is substantially changing the permit program that we have been implementing for the last 20 years. The permit program will need to be all-encompassing in the future in respect. It needs to include all federal standards. It has a focus on implementing technology to reduce the emissions of hazardous air pollution. We need to have some type of voluntary system so people who don't actually cause the amount of pollution where permits are needed can opt out of the program. And it involves compliance activities as well as interaction with the public and EPA. In essence, it'll change what we have now, where we issue permits to about 170 different facilities statewide to about 450. So it's almost a tripling of the number of businesses, industries, and commercial enterprises that will need permits in response to what the Clean Air Act is telling us to do. Because the Act gets down to the small industries and businesses, Congress created what is called the Small Business Assistance Program. It's to help the small companies who they realize have a burden placed on them more so than the larger companies have been dealing with this in the past, to help them understand and comply with the Act. This, of course, is very important to all states and, of course, to Alaska as well. Another major feature of the Act is what is the Acid Rain Reduction Program, to deal with what is principally an East Coast problem, a mountainous problem, somewhat in the western states, from emissions of sulfur oxides and nitrogen oxides. We in Alaska are exempt from that. It's a major part of the Act that we do not have to mess with at all, which is rather fortunate. It just helps the bureaucracy. Of course, there's an enforcement role to make sure that people are complying with the Act. If the state doesn't take the lead in that, EPA will take the lead. And we're interested in having the state serve as the one-stop shop on the permit program. So if the regulated community deals with the state, and they know what the rules are, they understand the rules, they don't have to worry about EPA intervening, that everything is through the state. Another major change is Congress created 189 hazardous air pollutants. This is a brand new list, mostly organic solvents, metals that are in certain solvents or metals by themselves that are hazardous air pollutants. Our permit program and our whole efforts for the last 20 years have been focused around 7 air pollutants. Now we're dealing with an additional 189. It's not quite as bad as it sounds in that the current program of 7 sets what is called ambient air quality standards, which is the safe level of a pollutant in the air that you breathe. That's a major concept of this whole air quality arena. Is ambient air is that level that you breathe. You have ambient air quality standards for these 7 air pollutants. Then you have out-of-stack standards, or called emission standards. So you base your out-of-stack limits on how much can you put out of a given stack so that when it is diluted X amount and reaches the ground, it's still within safe, breathable levels. With a hazardous program, we aren't going to have ambient air quality standards. At least we're not going to have for many years yet. Congress said, let's tackle hazardous air pollutants by looking at what technology is available and using that technology for the largest or major sources of hazardous air pollutants, and phase that in over the next 10 years and see where that gets us. After that 10 years, if there's still some public health problems and hazardous air pollutants, then they'll consider other options. So the focus on the hazardous program is technology only at this point and phasing in over several years. Those are the major features of the Act that we now need to deal with. The permit program itself, this is an example of who's going to need permits, how we are doing it in the existing world in Alaska, and how the changes occurred relative to 1990 Act. Right now, if you have a new facility that emits 250 tons of air pollution a year, it will need a permit. There are many existing facilities that have been in operation since the 60s and 70s that don't have permits that have more than 250 tons. The new law will require any installation, new or existing, over 100 tons per year to need a permit. This is the primary reason from going from 170 to 450 permits a year, or 450 total permits. The rules for incinerators will stay about the same. One of the major new permitted entities will be rural diesel generating equipment. Right now, the rules say that if you're a new engine of about 2350 horsepower, which is about 1750 kilowatt hours generating capacity, you'll need a permit. Under the new law, any new or existing greater than 740 horsepower, which is about 550 kilowatts, we'll need a permit. These are relatively small units. Will sit in the back easily of a tractor-trailer combination, or sit on a bed and can be moved around, enclosed. I mean, some of the larger airports will have units like this sitting on standby. Some of the larger hospitals may have units this size. The petroleum refineries and other oil and gas related activities, most need permits now, most will need to have permits in the future. We currently require permits for industrial processing, where you process more than 5 tons per hour, either physically or chemically processed material. That is doesn't equate well to the new program, but most of those facilities will need permits in the future. As well as you'll then, these sources of hazardous air pollutants. Congress said if you emit 10 tons per year of a hazardous air pollutant, you are a major source of hazardous air pollutant of any one of the 189. If you emit 25 tons in aggregate of any combination of them, you're considered a major source. So just to recap in words as to who needs permit, there's really three major criteria. The first one is 100 tons per year of air pollution of what are called the criteria air contaminants: carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, lead, particulate matter, ozone, and organic emissions. 10 tons per year of any hazardous air contaminant out of this list, 189, or 25 tons in aggregate of any multiple number. Third category is if you are subject to a specific federal emission standard. It falls under two categories here. One is what is called the New Source Performance Standards, which means a boiler that's built in 1995 should be able to meet tighter emissions than a boiler that was built in 1965. And so there's emission standards for new equipment or new large sources of air pollution per ton. Those are the categories. This last summer we did a survey where we sent out letters to some 8,000 businesses and commercial enterprises in Alaska to get basic information to find out who was going to need a permit under this Clean Air Act. This is the outcome of that, where this spreads out what we're projecting how the 450 falls out. You'll see the largest increase in the bottom one here, which is electric utilities, indicating that we may have up to 140 to 150 permits for electric utilities. In a nutshell, this means most of your larger villages and smaller towns. Many of the smaller villages will not need permits. It appears from that work that many, or perhaps, you know, neighborhood of half or so of the smaller villages, those in the range of 100 to 200 people may not need permits. Oil and gas related activities will see a substantial increase. You can't see very well in the overhead here, but on your printed copy, the light gray shows the future ones, where the black shows the existing numbers. Mining industry, seafood processing, and you get down to some of the smaller activities, including things like a few of the dry cleaners. I think we have about three or four of the largest dry cleaners in the state will need permits. Some of the gasoline distribution centers, sand and gravel operations where they crush gravel. Those are the small companies that will need permits. The numbers are relatively low for those installations. And those are indeed the types of businesses that we use the Small Business Assistance Program to a large extent. But you see, this kind of gives you an idea of where things are happening. And because of what you see here with electric utilities, a lot of this will affect the rural communities of Alaska. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of where we focused our work in working with the regulated community and the local governments and the environmental community over this fall in developing this bill, and some of the major design features of this, what you have now in the bill, is some of the principal focuses here are that retain state jurisdiction, because we feel the state, although in true essence this is not a DEC bill in front of you, this is a bill that will help all Alaskans deal with the Clean Air Act. But we feel it's in the best interest of all Alaskans that the state retain jurisdiction, because we feel that DEC, the state, can serve that role better for all Alaskans than EPA can. We feel we can be more responsive to the needs, and that would mean preventing federal intervention. Right now, the permit program we have is not what you call a full program. We don't have delegation on all aspects of federal law. So right now, a regulated party has a permit from us, and there may be one or two federal rules that apply to him that aren't in that permit. So he may get a call from EPA that says, you're out of compliance with this feature or that feature, and in some cases, they weren't aware of it. But we will definitely want to change that, so that the whole permit concept revolves around, you have one permit from the state, it lists everything in the Clean Air Act that applies to you. You live by that permit, you are complying with all 500 pages of that Clean Air Act, the portions of that Clean Air Act that apply to you. So that you know that if you live by that permit, you're not going to have a phone call from the federal government saying, here's a summons to appear in court on this issue. That is one of the principles that we're coming here with. The other is that this bill has a lot of checks and balances in it. For all parties. We need to protect public health. But in serving that role, we need also to be accountable for good science and making the decisions about protecting public health. There's a check and balance in here to make sure that the agency, as it looks at the need to regulate beyond federal law, does so with the best science that can be obtained, and does so with full participation with the regulated community and the general public. The fee structure, this permit system, Clean Air Act mandates that the permit program be self-sustained by the permit fees, meaning that everybody gets a permit is going to have to pay a fee in the future to share the cost burden of implementing this program. That's one of the obligations that we cannot sidestep in the Act, because Congress mandated it because of the way the past history has worked. But this fee structure that was developed over the fall is designed to stimulate efficiency from both the government end and the regulated community end, where there is an approach that fosters lower cost for applications that are complete and look at the situation and are concise, as well as there is an approach to make sure the DEC isn't spending undue time in processing an application and therefore causing increased cost to the regulated community. So there's a balance in here, checking a balance to make sure the costs are held down, as well as fostering lower cost for people who can do things in an efficient manner and complying with the Act. Public participation. The Clean Air Act requires that we have public participation in every permit action here. So there's an opportunity for public participation. So there's an allocated period, but there's a set period which is time certain. So once the time is over, a permit is either issued or denied. And then one of the other features, principal features, is this idea of general permits that will be used for many of the smaller regulated community, the smaller facilities, where you develop what is called a master permit that can be used for similar installations. So you may have asphalt concrete plants. So there's basically two different designs of concrete plants. So you build maybe two different master general permits. Once you put that through public review and EPA has approved it, then it can be issued almost over the counter to individuals a new asphalt plant. The same would hold true with rural electric generating plants. We'll probably have more categories, but we'll have certain size groups so that we don't have to have redundancy and bureaucracy in issuing these permits, and they can be very efficient in time, as well as the cost can be held down in general permits. and certainly not last on this, is the fact that we need to have a permit system where everybody knows the rules. Everybody understands the process, so everybody knows when to expect a product, everybody knows when to expect, well, how to know to comply with the state program, as well as what to expect of DEC. So that's not the way it is now. Our regulations are relatively brief and very open to different interpretations. So it's not clear right now. It's not easy for the regulated community to understand, how do I get a permit for this type of activity or that type of activity, and do so quickly and know the rules at the outset so everybody doesn't have misconceptions as people go on. That has to change, and that's one of the intents of this whole permit restructuring, is to get that done. That's essentially it. I do want to just throw up quickly the idea of, give some of the basic dates of what are called the sanctions, meaning that if the state doesn't implement in this timely manner, what happens. The principal deadline, as Representative Hanley mentioned, is this coming fall, where we have to have the permit program into the federal government, which means we have to have a bill enacted, and we have to have supporting regulations into EPA. If we miss that date, or the program isn't satisfactory, there is a period where EPA can choose to invoke these sanctions or withdraw monies from the state, basically, or they can choose not to. That starts after the November deadline, and they have basically 18 months to be discretionary. After that 18 months, after May 15 of 95, EPA must impose the sanctions, which are principally the loss of federal highway grant funds, as well as a number of other items, but the big dollar item is the highway grant funds. So in a nutshell, that's a glimpse at what consequences are if we don't do this, as well as EPA then must implement permits in Alaska. And they will do so out of Seattle, and I would say be far less responsive to the concerns of Alaska. So, Mr. Chairman, that's my overview. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take a guess. That's
Jeff Otteson.
Is that the time?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Jeff Otteson with the Department of Transportation, and I'll be brief. The point I wanted to make was just made. The state's failure to basically do what EPA will do anyway will mean that we're in jeopardy of our federal highway funds. It's discretionary at first, and then it's mandatory. We have faced these types of sanctions for any number of other things that we have to do. Speed limit laws, drinking laws, motorcycle helmet laws, seatbelt laws, and on it goes. These other sanctions have been discretionary. They've been up to someone's discretion, and the total sanction amount has generally been 10% or less. The air quality sanction is 100%, and it's non-discretionary after that 18-month deadline. So it's very serious. Congress basically is, it's got the axe over our heads, and as much as we may dislike it, I just want to let you know. The other thing is, he mentions the three airports that are also could not be expanded or further projects in non-attainment areas. Those would be the airports in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks that would be at risk. So.
Thank you, Jeff. Representative Green, one question?
Yes, just real briefly, and maybe you or a prior speaker. Just a brief question. From the federal government, on each of these pollutants, you will get a mandate that EPA, no matter whether there's an EPA office here or the one in Seattle, those are, as you say, non-discretionary. They will have certain numbers that we'll have to actually live up to.
In terms of different air pollutants, yes, those numbers are published in the law, and they're the state's non-attainment areas are above those numbers now, but they aren't seriously above those numbers. I think it looks like we're making progress. Anchorage was in attainment the entire year this year. Fairbanks, I think, had what, one or two spikes, so we're close.
Okay, thank you. What I would like to do is take testimony now from the teleconference network and shoot for perhaps a half an hour, 45 minutes, if there's that much, and then perhaps deal with the specifics to give us kind of an overview of the things that might want to be considered for those policy calls where there's non-agreement, and then Saturday we'll see if we can wrap it up. So if I could now, I don't have any sign-up sheets for the teleconference network. Is there anyone on site besides Anchorage?
No, just two so far.
Anchorage and two people?
No, Anchorage and
Juneau, Ohio. Juneau, Ohio. Okay. Well, let's go to Anchorage and ask the first person who's there to testify to please come forward and give us your name, affiliation, and your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Porter. This is Cheryl Richardson tonight. I am the only one here to testify at this point. I've been the only one this evening. My affiliation is with the Clean Air Coalition. We operate out of Anchorage, and we tend to focus on transportation issues. But since this is such an important piece of legislation, I've been following it now for the second year. Amy Boulanger has been representing our interests on the working committee put together by the Department of Environmental Conservation. We have a number of concerns that come from the bill as we are reading it today. We clear it up by time it goes to the Senate. The first major area we're concerned with is the most recent language we've read on setting standards more stringent than the federal. I'm not sure if people understand the implications of the different restrictions that are put on the state as they would set a new standard. I'm not sure I understand them from reading them just here tonight. But at any rate, I know the Anchorage Assembly has taken a position in its legislative package asking that they have the full right to set standards more stringent than the state. I don't see that addressed in this language. And I'm not really sure the Assembly will let them speak for themselves when they read this language, but they want to go through all these hoops in order to set those standards. And it's my opinion that a community should be able to set different kinds of standards as they will. For instance, think about the smoking in public buildings. Cancer producing problems with smoke and tobacco were still in court, still being litigated, but Anchorage went ahead and set its own standards. Another example for Anchorage would be the haze and visibility that we suffer when we've got cold, calm winter temperatures. Sometimes even in the summer, when the dust kicks up, we can't see our mountains and our... right here in town, the base of the mountains are obscured, or even the mountains across the inlet. I'm not sure how this section would allow Anchorage to move ahead and set its own standards. The other... major area we're very concerned about is the general operating permits. Again, as an example from Anchorage, we found that an incineration, a dirt burner, the folks that are coming in and helping reduce contaminated soils from the leaking underground storage tanks, they do so by burning the dirt. Those folks are permitted, one example in Fairbanks, and then relocated to Anchorage and were not required to go through public notice requirements. All of a sudden they showed up on the Ship Creek area. And this is not sufficient protection for communities who are not geared up to protect themselves from incineration. We're very concerned that a general permit will not be understood by the public and that the opportunity to comment will be missed. All of a sudden, facilities are going to show up in close proximity where people are living and working and recreating, and that the section as it's written today does not protect people from the sudden appearance of air quality deterioration and dirty air. The other, we're very concerned, I'll just one more third real quickly, the duration of operating permits. Again, in the Anchorage example, we've got a fellow who's incinerating out in South Anchorage. He's been violating the law. He's been violating his permit for years. His permit is up right now. I understand it will be written for a period of 1 year. To write that permit for 5 years with a known violator, in my opinion, the man should be shut down. He's, for a variety of reasons, allowing toxins and particulates into neighborhoods, simply not reasonable. ADEC feels differently. They will be permitting him, but certainly to permit a violator for a total of 5 years at a time is not a reasonable result. So we have other concerns, and we'll be following the bill as it comes through committee. I know that people really count on the law. They count on the Clean Air Act, and they count on you folks there in Juneau to protect them with these laws. And I urge you to maintain that covenant with your constituents and look out for their interests. What they're breathing, it hurts little kids to breathe this stuff. And I really do hope that you look out for your constituents as you write this law and remember what we're all here for. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Cheryl. For the benefit of my committee, Cheryl Richardson has been active in air quality concerns in Anchorage for a long time and involved. Are there any questions? Representative Nordland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have really a question for Cheryl, but I do have a question for probably Mr. Chappell in regards to one of her comments. Is the general permit section that's in this bill, is that something that's been, that was required by the federal government in terms of compliance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nordland, the general permit feature is an elective of the state. It's an option that exists at state discretion. And we feel it's an important feature in trying to reduce the effort in implementing this program. If the state was not to do this program, but EPA was to do the permit program, they would not have the tool of general permits.
Could I ask, for the benefit of those who are somewhat naive in this area, what is the difference between a general permit and, I guess, what, a specific permit?
Mr. Chairman, the general difference the difference is that a general permit would be constructed to serve a broad number of installations that are similar, and it would be developed and aired for public review at one time, and then would be issued without additional public review to anybody who fit that description of the facility. So if you felt that take the example of asphalt plants, that where asphalt plants move around the state and are common throughout the state, we would probably hold public review on that general permit through at numerous places throughout the state. Once that public review is concluded, and then once EPA reviews and approves the permit or doesn't object to it, we would that permit would be a final permit. That would, in essence, sit on the shelf, and then asphalt company came in and said, I would like to have that general permit number 123, we would have, he would submit the application form to tell us where he is located and that he fits that description, and then the permit would be issued without additional public review.
If I could, one follow-up. Are there not climatic conditions that differ around the state that have a bearing on suitability for that general permit in one location as opposed to another?
Mr. Chairman, indeed there are those kinds of factors that need to be considered, because in Anchorage you currently have poor air quality a number of days of the year, and part of the job that DVC will have in developing these permits is to examine where that type of activity could occur without infringing upon violation of standards. So in this process we may indeed find that we need to look at locale specific concerns, and that would be part of the development of these types of permits. And maybe one particular type of general permit wouldn't necessarily cause a concern statewide, or another type of general permit, you might have to say that within certain locales we don't want to issue a general permit, we want to go through a separate review and have a specific permit issue. But that's part of the work that would have to be done.
This bill would give you the regulatory power to create those kinds of situations?
Yes, it does.
Representative James.
Same question. That was the same question I was going to ask.
Are there any other questions of Tom?
Chairman, are there any other public people?
Are there any witnesses that would like to testify at the Juneau LIO?
That's us.
Oh, well, Ben. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify? I see none. Cheryl, has anybody else showed up in Anchorage?
No, I'm still here by myself, and I sure do appreciate your folks putting this on teleconference. It's real important to us to have this access, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Mr. Chairman, could I respond to a couple of things?
Yes, please. Representative Hanley.
Thank you. And Tom may want to as well. I mean, the right lanes, I believe, that might be true. So you start seeing that there's a lot of similarities in the kinds of programs. People don't understand the kinds of businesses that are going to be regulated by this. It's not just oil refineries and electric utilities. There's some small mom-and-pops dry cleaners that might qualify under a general operating permit. And generally, they would not be mobile moving into a community. The other thing, under general operating permits, Cheryl had mentioned some concerns about a particular operator and the duration of the permits, and I think maybe Tom should go through the process. I think through compliance orders and others, they have ways of forcing folks to either meet them or able to shut them down if they don't meet those permits, so that having a, and that's one of the things I mentioned earlier, is the duration of the permits that they were initially offered for, and in this bill it's 5 years. And there's some explanations for that, but maybe Tom could go through how, if you get a 5-year permit, you know, and people are just going all over the place and not complying with that permit, you know, does that just mean for the next 5 years you got to live with it? And maybe Tom could answer that.
Mr. Chairman, there are specific provisions in the bill that under this section that's called termination, modification, reopening of permits by the department, that would allow the department to take action when there is a non-compliant situation. Typically, the way we handle that is once a facility is out of compliance, you of course go through what we call the discovery phase to realize what the problem is and make sure that there is a problem. And then there's a mechanism, an effort to try to fix the problem. That fixing the problem is often dealt with through a compliance order by consent, where you lay out a milestone chart and agreement between the regulated party and the agency with some public review, perhaps more in the future than it has been now, but basically lays out a schedule to fix the situation. And so there is authority in here for the department, if there's a facility starts to violate their permit, to say essentially, hey, what's going on? Is there a compliance problem? If there is, then let's modify your permit and let's engage in this compliance order by consent or a compliance schedule to, so that there is an effort to fix it. And of course, if people, typically that agreement has penalties for missed dates or other enforcement actions can be taken if there isn't an effort towards fixing the problem. So in a sense, even though the bill says 5-year permits, if there is a significant change in the permit, if there's a compliance problem, the department can interrupt that to correct the course. And many times that may still mean that the permit is still valid for 5 years, but there is an additional document of correction, so to speak, of an agreement to fix the problem.
Representative Porter?
Yes.
Cheryl Richardson from Anchorage. In studying the incineration problem in South Anchorage, which was a new area for me, I asked ADEC in Anchorage, did they know of any air quality permit applicant who had been denied their permit? The answer was no. I asked if any operator had ever been shut down, they ever lost their permit. The answer was no. So we looked into the compliance orders that had been given this particular operator, and they had not been followed. The original permit conditions are not met today. ADEC has now compromised from those positions and is not even following EPA recommendations on the subject. EPA does not have official guidance yet. They are way behind in producing their rules. They do have recommendations. Those recommendations are not being followed by ADEC. So it's a continuing concern of neighborhoods in Anchorage about the enforcement capabilities of our agency. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. Representative James.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is similar to what Representative Porter was asking earlier, and it has to do with the general permitting and how it would be affected. Would there be any provision for any seasonal permits that after a certain time during the year that the permit wouldn't be allowed? And also then I was concerned about the location. And then one more thing too, so you can answer all these at the same time, is that whether or not, by the way this law is written, would a municipality be able to impose more greater restrictions than what the state law would require? I would see that maybe like in Anchorage or Fairbanks, they might want to do that.
And I'll go over that part, given our philosophy on what it would. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I might, on the, I'll start with the last part maybe on, and that's, Cheryl brought that up as well, it's called the 010 section. It is the place where the standards are set. And the philosophy was, or at least mine and people that I've talked to, was this is a new federal law that's putting many new standards on the state for all kinds of new particulates, emission standards, all kinds of hazardous emissions and releases. The feeling was that the state should not be able to go beyond the federal standards unless they showed just cause for that. And this is one of the areas that is controversial, I guess, in the statute. If you look on page 2, it starts with the emission control regulations. Basically, this would apply to the local as well. Whatever the provisions are here, we've applied. Local communities can adopt their own air emission program as well. And under this, the same steps the state would have to go through, basically, to show to adopt standards that are higher than federal standards, than the local groups would have to go through. And if you look, basically, it says they may. On line 17, it says the department may adopt the following types of regulations only after public hearing and compliance with 4614015, which we'll get to in a second. But basically, it talks about they have to adopt the public process for regulations that establish air quality standards for which there is no corresponding federal standard or to go above those standards. And then if you go to, and it says the kinds of things that they have to do, they have to demonstrate that exposure profiles or meteorological conditions are significantly different in the state or area from those upon which a federal standard is based, that the conditions reasonably require a more stringent ambient air quality standard, emission standard to protect human health and welfare of the environment, and that the proposed standards are technologically and economically feasible, so that you don't get either a local community or the state department going out there and saying, oh, we want no emissions coming out of your stack, which is technically impossible, potentially. So they have to show these things, and they have to go through the public process, basically, to do that. And then if you look at 015, which starts on line 20, there's what's called a peer review process. And before they can adopt a regulation, the department has to publish written findings that the factors up above are met, and that they have to justify the written findings justifying the regulations. Then they submit those findings to a peer review group, I guess, of three independent people, and it goes through the different, how they're technically qualified and how the process is, how they participate in the process. And then the peer review people submit their report. It's basically then available for the public review of the regulation, so that the department essentially has certain findings it has to make, showing that there's a need, a health standard, a reason within a particular area to do this, to go above state standards. Then they submit that to the peer review group. Peer review group makes their report on those, saying, yes, we think that's valid or no, we don't. Those reports are also available at public hearings, and then the regulations continue at that point. And that's kind of the process. So there's checks and balances. It's not impossible for the state or a local area to adopt more stringent regulations, but it is not just a particular commissioner or a particular region that may adopt their own, saying we're going to be five times more stringent than the federal government, having no rational reason for it, potentially causing problems for either industry or the regulated community.
If I may, this is the same process then that a municipality, for example, would go through if they wanted to adopt stricter standards.
Exactly. We've kind of tied their program back to go through the same kind of process. So there is an ability to do that, but there have to be findings based on some of these standards to do that. And again, like I said, this is one of the areas that is somewhat controversial. Some groups would like to have the department have full authority to exceed federal standards at any time that they choose to do so.
So. There was a second part to your question?
Well, that was the last part. That was the second part.
Oh.
But just to follow up on that second part is that it seems to me, and this I guess more is less the statement, it seems to me that and having in the statute that the DEC is not able to establish regulations that would exceed the federal standards without going through all this experience here would make sense. But what I would, if I was a local group, I would not like to be tied to those things. It seems to me like the local, they would have public a hearing process to go through, but it seems to me like they shouldn't have to be tied to such stringent ones as what the state would be.
If I could make, one of the things that wasn't, I'm not sure it was pointed out, I was kind of reading as Tom was talking, is the way the federal government requires this whole program to be set up is basically to create a dedicated fund. And the cost of running this particular permitting program is required to be paid for by the industry that's regulated, or the regulated groups, so that all the costs are borne by the people that are being regulated. And that's kind of a scary concept, and it is a dedicated fund that we as a legislature do not have the ability to appropriate out from, because it's under federal law. We can't have a dedicated fund under our constitution because the feds require it. So one of the concerns is that you have an ability now for a department to impose all kind of, you know, regulations, and if it's not checked and there aren't reasonable reasons for that, the industry and the regulated folks are going to have to pay the total cost of what of this program. And that's one of the things that is a concern, I think, for a lot of people in this, and that's one of the reasons that, you know, before anybody makes a big jump or imposes a standard, whether it's a local group or the state, that could cost an awful lot of money as far as regulations, and that there's that there needs to be a reasonable process that they have to go through to justify why they want to have higher standards.
Representative Porter?
We have a follow-up here in Juneau first, please.
I guess that my question is that in this permitting, the permitting is going to be done extensively and exclusively, I guess, by the DEC. And is there no input whatsoever then from local people into that permitting process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Chan, this bill is structured to bring local governments in as partners with the state in implementing the permit program at the local level, provided local governments or collections of local governments want to combine and form a district. And so it's the Clean Air Act is developed on having a permit agency or single entity. However, it's also developed that you could have either standalone local governments or partnerships. Because of the complexity of this law and the types of facilities or industries that exist in most of our cities, it's probably not beneficial for any of our local governments to have a standalone program, because there's certain types of unique expertise that are required only occasionally. And so the efficiency of having those experts in a local government where they aren't needed very often starts to reduce the efficiency of the whole program. So in essence, the department looks to have local governments as a partner, where we would be working with them. They may be serving as the front desk and doing a lot of the legwork, and we would provide special expertise, but it would be a joint effort. And in that sense, the permit fees would be used to support the local government people, so that even though the fees are all coming into the state dedicated fund, there is a way to provide financial assistance to local governments for the two people or the four people, whoever they have doing this permit program. Another point to clarify is that this review process, additional review for standards more stringent, only applies to the permit program part of it. Anchorage and Fairbanks have a very substantial program for controlling mobile sources, automobiles. This language does not affect those programs. So it is focused on the permit program, so that the permit program is relatively uniform statewide. Although we want to be sure that we can bring local governments in, because often they are better to help serve the needs of the local constituents. When this working committee was formed and working in the fall, a representative of the Municipal League, who happened to be Lee Browning, who was town of Anchorage, served and worked in the formation of this, and was, of course, very interested in the language that was developed on local government programs. And many of his concerns were met, because clearly they wanted to have the prerogative to do something unique because there are unique situations. But yet, the overall concern of having a good public involvement and a good assessment of the scientific information before one marches on it and decides to regulate beyond the federal law. Those were concerns that were discussed, and I believe were the group in the development of the bill was responsive to local government concerns.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Representative Porter?
I've got one here, and then you, Cheryl. Representative Green.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You indicated, Tom, I think, in your review of the bill that the acid rain
functions, the NOx and the SO2, we were going to be waived there. Is that something that's a benefit now? Because it seems to me that NOx was a concern on the North Slope. Is that no longer a problem, or is it a separate area?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, we still must be concerned about nitrogen oxide emissions. We still have this ambient or public health standard to attain, so we still are involved in regulating emissions of nitrogen oxide. The acid rain program is a program to ratchet down over time emissions of nitrogen oxides and sulfur oxides from power plants. And so there is a scheme where they have to nationwide reduce total emissions for, and I can't remember exactly what the numbers are because I've been fortunate enough to ignore that part of the act, but they have to reduce their emissions over time. And in essence, there is a bartering system, or there's a trading system that if I reduce my emissions more than the act requires, I can sell that additional reduction to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So as well as those types of emissions are monitored much more closely, the whole bureaucracy of implementing that is quite consuming, and that's what we're relieved of, is that ratcheting down.
This is possibly a little bit off the section, off the agenda tonight, but are you the one that would be involved with determining anything about oxygen in the fuels?
I can gladly say no.
After the meeting, you'll let me know who that is.
Yes.
Thank you.
Cheryl, go ahead.
Thank you. I want to follow up to the comments regarding the general permitting and the standards more stringent. It seems that the committee language that was agreed upon for standards more stringent is different from the section I'm reading tonight, 4614010. And perhaps the committee would have comments on the language as it's written tonight. The two times I've watched the state try to set standards more stringent than the federal were the ammonia standard for Nikiski Unocal urea plant and the benzene control over in Valdez at the Alyeska terminal. In both cases, industry led the state on a merry chase. They had greater financial resources to hire more experts, and they just plain outgunned our state officials in documenting health hazards and other problems. When you think of the, I haven't been to Valdez, I haven't experienced that one, but I have been to Unocal plant years before the standard was even proposed, watching the trees die from the ammonia releases. And yet, the state did not have the clout, even without this language, did not have the clout to outgun industry. So it's a continuing concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. The work draft that we have is dated 4/1/93. I doubt that you have it there, but it'll be available at the Anchorage LIO in a few days. Are there any further questions? Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom or Mark, I'm not sure who can answer this question. What was the position of the working group on the ability of the state to set more stringent standards? Did you take it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norden, the working group, when it started its work this fall, set a priority of those things that were absolutely essential features in the bill. And as it worked through those, several subjects came up upon certain times as should there be the ability to regulate a source that isn't currently regulated or to regulate an air contaminant. And it was debated quite some time. And basically, the working committee made a policy decision within itself to say that it should be appropriate for the agency to go beyond federal law if that decision is justified in an effort to protect public health of the environment and if the science is sound enough to warrant the activity. Now, when the working committee concluded its product before this legislative session started, the committee did not specifically take up this section 010 and 015 that existed last year or developed language at that time. But it did craft in about four locations in its draft the concept that that there should be the ability to go beyond federal law if there is a reasonable basis predicated upon sound science. Now, since the legislative session started, one of the issues of interest to many people was the language that was crafted last year in the section 010 and 015, which in greater detail described the review process and how to get to good science, so to speak. And so that came along after the working committee developed its initial language, and the working committee prepared an alternative to that language for the review of the legislature, and it was reviewed by the Senate Resources Subcommittee. So basically, the Senate Resources Subcommittee had a language proposal for the 010 and the 015 sections drafted by the working committee as an alternative to the language that was brought over from last year and embodied in the first version of House Bill 167. The Senate Resources Committee decided that essentially it wanted to seek a compromise, taking some of the features of both. And so it adopted language just earlier today, which basically is identical to the language that's now in the bill before you, where there it is slightly different than the language of the alternative language of the working committee, but yet in a large respect reflects the working committee language, as well as concepts that were in the bill from last year.
If I could follow up, either in the Senate subcommittee or during the working group, was there discussion as to why the normal regulatory writing process was not adequate to make sure that, you know, sound science was the basis for, you know, making more stringent regulations, or any of the other requirements you should have in the bill? I guess what I'm wondering is why we go through and create this peer review and the scientific, is the scientific review panel still in there also? Well, that's out. Okay. The peer review. Why is it necessary to go through that process as opposed to just the regular process of public hearings where experts would come in and have the ability to comment on proposed regulations? I'm just wondering why that was the standard process is not adequate.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and that's this is one of the philosophical areas. I guess one of the concerns is that the regular regulatory process, as we all know, many times the administration writes what the administration wants to write, and there's not a lot of justification for it. It interprets laws much differently than the statutes have actually been written, and particularly in this area where we're adopting standards that are higher than we have now in a lot of areas, that there was a need to make sure that there was, that the department had to come out with their findings and make sure that they stated, rather than put out regulations just saying we think there's a problem, let's have a higher standard, that we lay out in the statutes some things that they shall do. They shall say these different things exist, that there's a health need, that there is technological feasibility to do what they're asking to be done, and then when they do that, to have a peer group review that. And I'm not sure, Tom could probably express that, you know, I don't know how often we're going to, I mean, I don't know that this is going to be 50, 60 times a year where the department expects to exceed the federal standards or feels it's necessary with or without this language, and that may be helpful. But my understanding is there's a few times, and that this isn't something that's going to occur 100 times a year. But
perhaps I could address that. It will be a relatively infrequent event. If you look at the past history as a track record, there's two cases in the recent past where the department has gone beyond federal law, and that is in setting a public health standard for ammonia that principally applies to the Unocal urea plant in Burkina. That was a process essentially where the department listened to a lot of public concern, started it with some field work and some investigatory work, and took about 2.5 to 3 years before the facts and information and the public process was completed and a decision made to adopt a standard for ammonia. There was a lot of work that went into that effort. The other case is a more recent in Anchorage, the Port of Anchorage, in the Government Hill community, where the collection of a number of fuel distributors in the port is immediately adjacent to a bluff where many residents live. And again, a public concern was aired, and the department spent about 2 years investigating and developing a standard, and now we're still involved in some of that work, as well as in that case, the outcome was there was a technology that's generally used quite frequently in the lower 48 that could be easily retrofitted and relatively cost efficient to the transferring of bulk fuels, both from rail cars and trucks, that will be implemented by 1995. So in both those are the two cases, really, where the department has gone beyond federal law. When we implement this permit program, there are a few sources that we require to have permits now that really don't meet the 100-ton criteria. Some of those are small to moderate-sized incinerators. Municipal incinerators, the size of the municipal incinerator in Sitka does not generate 100 tons per year of air pollution, nor do I believe it emits 10 tons per year of hazardous air pollution. But yet that's the type of source that has a lot of public concern and can indeed, if improperly operated, cause public health problems. So there will be, as we move into this new program, we will have to look at some of those facilities and assess, do we need to require permits of these facilities or not? And perhaps there are some that we will not, and perhaps there are some that we will. That will be part of the first development phase. But in essence, we will probably use this tool very frequently. It will probably be once or twice every 5 or 10 years.
Representative,
Mr. Chairman, there's, depending on which side you look at here, this peer review, I think, some folks think, well, the department should be able to do it, and this peer review group isn't needed, and they should be able to go out there. And as was pointed out, it takes them a long time. There are industry groups out there that have a fair amount of resources available to them. And I would also suggest that if the department actually comes out with these findings, there's a sealed bid contract thing that they have to put out here for the peer review group of three different people. And I suggest that if the department came out with findings and the peer review group actually came back supporting those findings, I would think that would make it, on an independent basis, I would think it would make it much stronger a case for the department to exceed those standards at that point for any future thing that they had to, versus the department going directly against an industry who's, so if it ever got to a court or something like that, that would give a stronger case for the department. Likewise, if the department puts something out and the peer review group says, it's full of holes, it doesn't make sense, I think it would be hard for the department then to justify going on. And I guess that's kind of where this give and take, it could be beneficial to either side, I think, and I guess the question is, can you get an independent peer group that's what's trying to be done here? And I think the process is served by that peer group trying to make sure that, a little give and take on both sides, and it could support either side.
President Garland?
Just one quick follow-up. Is there, I'm concerned about the potential makeup of the peer review panel. Is there an opportunity for, say, an expert who is not associated with industry, who has the interests of public health in mind, to sit on the peer review?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nordland, the peer review group will serve not as a collective body, but as independent, so that you will have, the process may unfold something like this, that if you were looking at the Port of Anchorage situation today, and looking at regulations, you would say, I want to find an expert who knows about fuel distribution, an expert who knows about the public health impacts of benzene, or if we can find one who knows both sides of that issue. And you may select, it says three as a minimum, but it doesn't mean you're limited to three. If you have and can acquire a couple experts to a contract arrangement that know the fuel transfer and the technology, and have another one or two experts in the health effects part of it, then they'll all work independently. So that's one of the concepts here, is you're not having a collective body sit down and come up with one idea. You're having at least three parties generate their own ideas and critique the department's findings. It is only to critique the department's findings. If it finds major holes in the department's work, then that tells the agency that they better go back and do their homework, or that the effort, the proposed regulation, doesn't have merit. But the idea is to get a number of independent views to the commissioner, so that when the commissioner then sits down and looks at the original findings that his staff developed and the views of these at least three independent experts or authorities in the field, that he would have that as other information to make a decision. And yes, it could be some person in state with public interest at heart. It's not specifically identified here. There was some language that talked about trying to make sure that it was to describe who was independent, and that was one of the, that was crafted in what was the working committee's proposal, but the final version felt that that was, that it was clear enough to obtain that without describing in detail how to get independence.
Yeah, and I would point out that it is the department that essentially picks these people. They have, so it's, I don't know if you want to say it, and that's been a concern of the regulated folks as well. I mean, the department essentially has to pick people who are technically qualified in subject matter under review. And that's basically, they can't be employees of the department, and they have to be technically qualified in subject matter under review. And that's, those are the standards for the three reviewers, and the commissioner actually picks them, and then it says the department shall contract with persons to perform peer review under this section, and all persons shall be selected on the basis of competitive sealed bid proposals. But so the department would put those proposals out and then pick, who they want to do the review. So I don't think it's, you know, for people that are concerned about the regulated community, they're not the ones picking people to review the, but they are semi-independent of the commissioner and reviewing these findings, and as you mentioned, making them, you know, either justifying their findings or making them back up some more.
I wonder, I'm going to guess that 010 and 015 fall into the category of a couple of sections that might not have total unanimous approval. Could you give us a kind of executive summary of the other two or three, I think, that you said existed, so that you have those in mind while we're
coming sure. on One was the duration of permits, and that was, we've kind of gone over that already, and you know what that means up to your head.
Section 230 is duration of permits. On page 14.
And Mr. Chairman, I, on the duration operating permits, basically it is a fixed term of 5 years. And the department had originally, even last year, there was debated that it said 3 years. With one of the concerns, I think, of the regulated community is it can be expensive to go through a permit process. Very expensive, particularly on some of the more expensive ones that could happen that are not necessarily general operating permits, and that if if they can go through this process and get a permit for 5 years, and they are complying with that permit, and there's no reasons to modify it, things haven't changed. I mean, I guess my feeling would be that gives them the ability to have that 5-year permit, but the department has, through termination or modification and with compliance orders, the ability to go back in and make changes if necessary, or terminate if necessary the permit, so that it was in the interest of having a little longer permit so that the costs could be held down every so many years, but that they have the flexibility.
Coincidence that it's the same period in driver's license.
I guess.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seemed like APD permits in the past were not only expensive, but they were very time consuming. Now, is it your feeling that with this being transferred to the state, that while you may have the same requirements, that the turnaround time may be significantly reduced once this policy is in place?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, it's not a real straight answer on that. Some permits for the larger facilities must go through certain federal reviews that are time consuming, that are require very technical analysis of pollution control equipment. That is not going to change, because it can't. There's no provision for it to change. We can streamline our efforts, which we are going to do, to try and make sure that permit applications are laid out well, so people know exactly what they need to submit, so there's less confusion in that effort, and that will help reduce it. But the actual review time won't change for those types of facilities. Where we have focused efforts to try and make it speedier is the smaller facilities, or the facilities that are very similar to each other, where that generally our department's thoughts are many of these smaller facilities, such as the rural power installations, don't cause a public health concern. And so if you use the vehicle of a general permit, then you expedite the process. You have the review requirement, the review opportunities, so that people know what's going on, but yet when it comes down to issuing the permit, it can be quick and responsive, and the cost is shared by a number of people who have similar installations, and so their cost is only 1/7 or 1/10 of what it would be to get that permit reviewed and issued, because the legwork was done for a group rather than for a single. As well as there's a feature in here that deals with temporary facilities, ones that move around the state, such as some of the oil production service companies that have well work, or well drilling, or well makeover work. They have equipment they pull out in the field for 2 or 4 months or for a year to do work. But one company may have 5 units that he moves around to 10 job sites. Well, there's a feature in here with temporary, called temporary operating permits, that will allow him to have a permit that will enable him to move around. And yet, the obligation is for him, when he applies for a permit, to tell us where he's going to be, so that when we review his application, we know that he will comply with the standards, the public health standards, at each of those 5 locations or whatever it is. And that when we take it to public review, we take it to public review at all 5 of those locations. But then he has the flexibility to move when his one job is done. He doesn't have to wait for DEC to review his permit and reissue it again. That he can move with a quick notice to the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You indicated that if there were 5 or 7 that were going in for a similar type permit, that that could be shared. Is there going to be a time limit? Say that then an 8th one comes along a little bit later. Will there be any merit there, or will the fact that the 7 have established a tentative break, will the 8th one be on that rate, or will he go back up? Or?
The 8th one would be on the same rate.
Okay. And then the final question, once this is passed, do you have any feel for how long it might be before companion regulations and maybe even guidelines might follow?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, as I showed you from the overhead, and as Representative Hanley indicated, we have to have all this done by November 15 of this year.
Mm-hmm.
Reality is, we won't. There is too much substance in regulation to accomplish, as well as we want to have an interactive effort in the reg development, as we did in developing the draft statute, so that all the affected parties have an opportunity to participate. What you have in a bill here as 30-some pages will wind up being probably a 1 in front of that for regulations. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Some of it, a large amount of it, is procedural. But we want to use the regulated community and other affected parties to help us with the development of policy decisions, where there are choices to be made in flexibility, choices to be made on certain subjects, or how to make the gears mesh, and how to design the gear, so to speak, that the affected parties are involved in that. So in reality, I truthfully think it will be something like next spring before the regulatory package is complete and sent to EPA. I think if we made every effort to meet the November deadline, we would short circuit the opportunity for public involvement and involvement with all parties.